Today we're going to talk to you about a project that we've been doing for a couple of years at Lucy Parsons Labs, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that does police accountability journalism and digital security. I'm Jen.
And I'm Camille.
But first, we want to take a little bit of time to make a comment about some of the events that occurred yesterday. So I don't know if everyone saw this statement was published, signed by a bunch of organizations and individuals, including Lucy Parsons Labs.
On a personal note, I seriously considered not giving the session today. I don't think that, in general, I don't think people should speak at conferences that protect and enable fascists, cops, and rapists and bring them into their spaces. I ended up deciding to try and use this part of this time in this platform to speak about my work, but also to acknowledge what happened yesterday. I'm not totally sure what the right thing to do in this situation is, whether that's speaking or not. And if you have thoughts about that, I'd love to connect with you one-on-one sometime perhaps after the session. Several people throughout yesterday reported incidents of harassment by right-wingers to Hope Security, and these kinds of things included fascists yelling in people's faces and waiting by the elevators to target individuals. Hope organizers have failed to take these complaints seriously, even in some circumstances, saying that these were not sufficiently targeted threats. Hope has failed to take action and has created a space where that is safe for fascists and not for the people who are speaking and who are vulnerable.
So we decide what community we want to have, and I think most people here, including us, would disagree with these statements that were made by at least one person at Hope Security about extremist right-wing symbols, and we should all decide about what we want the Hope Conference to represent going forward.
I'd also encourage you to check out the Medium statement that was recently written and add your name or your organization if you feel comfortable.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about the project. And first, we're going to motivate why we started working on this. So I'm going to tell a story of someone that we met a couple of years ago. So 2 years ago in Chicago, we met an individual that had been assaulted by a police officer at a protest. And this person tried to go to the police department and file a police complaint against this officer and was told that without the name or the badge number, the complaint will basically just get immediately thrown away. But the person did say this to us. This is pretty much a direct quote. If I ever saw their face again, I would recognize them. Is there anything that you can do? And so this project is to try to have a good answer to that question.
The story that we just told about someone who was assaulted by a police officer, you've probably heard countless stories like it. I personally, at protests I've attended, I've seen people beaten by the cops and pepper sprayed. Police regularly abuse their power, and accountability is oftentimes sparse. You probably heard similar incidents of police using lethal force against people who did nothing wrong. And who are these law enforcement officers? We pay for them with our tax dollars. They are increasingly militarized. They have increasingly powerful weapons that civilians don't have access to. And despite these vast, powerful capabilities, there's very few accountability mechanisms. And their test, this oftentimes translates into influence in courtrooms, for example, where their testimony is considered more credible, more reliable than that of private citizens.
So first, what mechanisms for accountability exist? So we're going to go through a few. Some are more effective than others. So the first is self-policing. For example, each police department, getting some laughs in the audience, each police department does have an internal affairs unit. Maybe that's not the right term. And they will investigate within the department and handle things internally and take whatever action is necessary, whether that's suspending an officer or sending that officer for additional training. That's not always effective. And so there's also a police complaints process that may funnel complaints maybe to the department directly or maybe to a civilian oversight agency. The story I told at the beginning about this individual, when we looked into it, there were widespread issues. It wasn't just a kind of rare event. The complaints process in Chicago where that event happened, it basically works as follows. An incident occurs, and then the person goes to a police department to register the complaint. Then they have to sign an affidavit. And this affidavit, if they misremember something or misrepresent something, they can be charged with a felony. And so that does discourage a lot of people from filing complaints. Then the investigators need to find the officer in question. If the name and badge number is given, it's easier to do so. But many complaints are thrown out. When we looked into this using data from a nonprofit called Invisible Institute that's acquired a lot of police complaints data, this is a pretty widespread issue. In a four-year period, a quarter or over a quarter of the complaints were thrown away, which corresponds to thousands of incidents of police misconduct that were not addressed in any way. And there are similar problems in other cities. So civilian oversight agencies exist to try to be an independent check on police power. But in many cases, unfortunately, these agencies struggle to maintain their independence. And this is a recent story from Baltimore where they're trying to reform the police accountability process within the civilian oversight agency. These agencies are unfortunately often underfunded and understaffed, and some, like in Baltimore, lack full investigatory and subpoena powers. And so it makes them really hard to actually do their work. There is also in the United States the Department of Justice, which does have the power to investigate local law enforcement via pattern and practice investigations, which will determine if there are widespread problems within the department. For example, if there's a practice of racially biased policing, or if there's a widespread practice of the unnecessary use of force. And these investigations result in court-enforceable reform agreements that are called consent decrees. And they specify the changes that departments need to make to address the issues that were uncovered in the investigation. And Chicago actually did recently have a Department of Justice investigation, and the report is available, the initial report is available for people to read. And the Department of Justice did find in the case of Chicago, and often find when they do investigate police departments, that it's not just a few bad apples, although you know what they say about a few bad apples. There are widespread problems within the department. So in this case, they found that the use of force, including shooting people, occurs without justification, and sometimes even in a contradiction to policy. So unfortunately, the landscape has changed significantly. The Obama administration did push the Department of Justice investigatory process with respect to local law enforcement. But Jeff Sessions, who's the Attorney General of the Trump Department of Justice, has been a longtime opponent of the use of consent decrees and believes that they are an overstepping of federal powers, and has even called them, I think, quote, dangerous. So we can't really rely on this institution, on these institutions to self-police, and we can't rely on them to kind of ride in and save the day. There are two other tactics that have been effective in some cases, and that is the use of campaigning, building a public campaign, and journalism. And that the goal there is to put public pressure on the police department, the city, and prosecutors to hold law enforcement accountable. In Chicago, there's actually a famous case of a police officer, John Burge, and he's a former police commander who, over a period of more than two decades, systematically tortured black men in the city into giving false confessions. So after they were tortured, they were then put in prison, and in some cases on death row for crimes that they didn't commit. And this happened for decades without anything really happening. But after a long public campaign, thanks to the work of dedicated community organizers and grassroots activists, the city agreed to provide reparations to the victims of torture. So that's really an amazing victory. And John Burge was charged and removed.
So if you get a bad haircut, you can leave a Yelp review about that and make that person's, for example, the bad experience that you had at a business. There's lots of different accountability mechanisms for situations like that. For example, you see a Yelp review in front of you of someone who had a bad experience with a medical professional. But unfortunately, the same doesn't really exist for government agencies. The Federal Trade Commission, for example, you can submit a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, to the Federal Trade Commission for all consumer complaints that were made against a specific company. For example, the one you see in front of you here is a request that was made on a government transparency website, MuckRock, to 23andMe, which provides ancestry information based on genetic information. And that doesn't really exist for government agencies. So I also want to acknowledge that when we started this project, it was originally intended to address the problems with the complaint filing process in Chicago, but accountability and justice look really, really different for everyone, and people want different things. Resolution can look different for everyone. For example, after some people have negative interactions with law enforcement, for some people, closure might look like getting that officer fired from the force, maybe suspended. Some people might want that officer to go through some sort of training to make sure that something like that never happens again. Other people might consider financial reparations and consider bringing legal charges against either the department or the officer himself. In many situations, people just want to share their stories and make sure that their community is aware of what happened to them. And in some situations, when police complaints actually end up in trial, for example, gag orders are placed on the survivors, so they actually can't oftentimes talk to the press about what happened, and the waiting of resolution in a trial situation becomes part of the punishment itself. So we hope that this project will assist a wide variety of accountability mechanisms.
So hopefully we've established that, like all powerful people, law enforcement should also have a robust accountability mechanism. So now we want to talk a little bit about police use of surveillance. So there's a really great site on the EFF page called Street Level Surveillance, which describes the different tools that are currently used by law enforcement. So if you're not familiar with some of them, I highly recommend you check that out. Briefly, those tools are automatic license plate readers, which are cameras that are mounted on vehicles or in a stationary location, and they do OCR on license plates, log the plate and the location of the vehicle. There's also body-worn cameras and CCTVs, and those are motivated by the argument that when you're in public, you have no expectation of privacy, something that we'll talk about later. There are also cell site simulators, which are fake cell towers, and the use of facial recognition, which can be integrated into body-worn cameras and CCTV systems, and the extent to which that is done varies city by city. And finally, there are drones. And a lot of that data is organized in fusion centers, which facilitates collaboration by law enforcement agencies on multiple levels.
So a wide variety of information is being gathered by the police on everyday citizens, and oftentimes this information is being misused by the police. So you see a few examples of that in front of you. A few years ago, the NYPD drove a car equipped with an ALPR, an automated license plate reader, and drove it along a street around a mosque and recorded the license plate of every single car that was parked outside of a mosque, for example. I also just want to mention that poor people, for example, are over-surveilled, right? And they have to reveal a great deal of personal and identifying information about themselves when they apply for food stamps and things like that, or apply for housing, and that information is, in some situations, shared with the police. It's oftentimes, this information is used in a targeted way, and it's often people of color, activists, and religious minorities who bear the burden of this surveillance.
So as a community that we often organize against police surveillance, and like our own organization, Lucy Parsons Labs, has done a lot of work at exposing what police are doing to surveil the public. Armed with that and the knowledge that this accountability process needs some additional assistance, that brings us to open oversight. And so the purpose of this transparency and accountability is just when it comes to a police officer's public-facing duties. So we've really scoped the project just to collecting only information that's relevant to their function as a police officer that's interacting with the public. So inspired by all these great tools for surveillance, we've got to get in on the game. And the first thing we need to do is start massing individual-level data on police. So that's actually a little bit difficult so on first inspection. Most people are aware that most cities, at least big cities, have these open data portals where there's usually quite a lot of data about criminal justice and policing. But it's rare that that information is linked to individual police officers. So I was looking at the City of Berkeley's API for police department arrests, and there's very fine-grained information available on arrestees, like their full name, very precise information about their selves and, you know, their weight, their age, height, etc. That's all available for anyone to download, but none of that is linked to individual officers.
So what information can we get? There's a few different tools available to the public to get individual level police officer data. We use FOIA to get the rosters of police departments in cities that we are implementing into open oversight. This is an example of one of those requests. So you might know that some jurisdictions require some information to be made affirmatively publicly available. In California, Transparent California, you might have heard of, you can view the salary and name of each public official or public employee in California. In New York, you can get, and just in New York City specifically, you can get, you know, the name of the names and salaries, including overtime pay, of all public employees in New York City, including NYPD. But this doesn't include a lot of the information that we want. For example, I found it pretty surprising when we started this project that you actually have to file a FOIA request to even get just a list of the officers in your city that includes badge numbers that isn't even required to be disclosed by police officers. So generally, this is the type of information that we request. In some situations, we're more successful than others in getting all of that, and some consider some of this information, like gender and race, to be exempt from disclosure. So here's what we have so far. So we started in Chicago, and we have this information on individual level officers in Chicago. Berkeley, for example, considered gender, race, and age to be exempt from disclosure. You might know under FOIA, agencies are not required to create new records for you, so they claimed that they didn't have a roster that listed age and the date that they joined the force. So with New York, we're just now expanding to NYPD, and we have the names of the officers from Open Data NYC, but we don't have any of the other information yet because our FOIA request is still in process, so we hope to get that soon.
So in addition to individual level data on demographics and duty, we also have officer images. And we can get those from two places. One is submissions from the public, and we've had people submit over 1,000 photos to us, and by scraping social media. So another police surveillance tool is social media surveillance. And since police often will post photographs of officers helping the community, then we can go and scrape all those photos. So we have, we wrote a script to just do that in an automated way on the police department accounts associated with every city that we're interested in. We go, we download all the photos, and we dump them into a database, and we'll talk about how we verify and sort through those photos in a bit. The requirements for those photos are, first, we're restricting it only to officers that are in their uniform in public. And that's because, police are not supposed to be a secret police force, and they have their name and badge number on the uniform for a reason, and so we're kind of scoping it just to that. And it's in public because, again, there's no expectation of privacy in a public space. And then their face needs to be clearly in the photograph along with the name and badge such that a volunteer can verify it and be like, indeed, Officer Bob, badge number 123, is associated with this face. The other data that is available in public on individual level cops are media stories, if there's been an incident, either negative or positive, associated with an officer. A lot of cop watch groups will post their footage to YouTube. And that is something that we can link out to. Lawsuits that individually name cops, those can also be linked to officers, obviously. And then incidents. So we'll talk about how hard it is to get incidents from the department. But there are police accountability groups that for decades have been privately collecting incidents data. So they go into the community, and if someone has a negative interaction, that will be logged. But the person might not feel comfortable filing a police complaint, or just will believe that it won't go anywhere, and so it just stays in, a spreadsheet that's kept on someone's computer. And there's data going back like 3 decades with some groups. It's really amazing the work that's been done.
And so you mentioned that there were some challenges getting the information about misconduct records from police. So in many states, including California and New York, police misconduct records are not actually considered public record. That's not the case in every state. So in Illinois, they are public record. So there's this great organization called the Invisible Institute that's based in Chicago. And they built an incredible police misconduct database on CPD officers using FOIA requests. And that's really, I found that to be really helpful, and it shed a lot of light on the details of police misconduct in Chicago. In states like New York and California, it's a lot more difficult. BuzzFeed recently, from a source, really received the police misconduct history of, I think it was several years on thousands of different NYPD officers. They redacted parts of this information, for example, the tax registry numbers of the officers. But and NYPD responded by threatening, the NYPD union threatened to respond with an injunction, which a threat that never materialized. But you can see that police respond very strongly to the details of their misconduct history becoming public.
So total aside, if you are a law enforcement officer and have access to this data, or you otherwise have access to this data, please leak it to us. We have a secure drop, and we have instructions how to use it on this slide. Basically, download Tor Browser, go to that onion address, or at lucyparsonslabs.com/securedrop. But I recommend you download Tor first. Just throwing that out there. So now we're going to step through. So we have put all of this data that we have available in a database, and there's a web application that you can access at openoversight.com. So we're just going to step through what it looks like from the perspective of someone who wants to find a particular officer maybe that they've interacted with on the street.
So essentially, the way that it works now is that there's a few different features that Open Oversight offers. So users can visit our website and search for information about a specific officer they might want to file a complaint about. They can also put information that they know about an officer. So if they were assaulted, they can fill in a few different fields, and we generate a list of possible matches for who that officer might be that might assist them to file a complaint or empower them to do whatever they feel like is right for them to do with that information. So essentially, this is what the form looks like. So step one is to select a department. And you saw some of the departments that we've added to Open Oversight so far. If you remember any part of the officer's name or badge number, if we have that information, that helps us narrow it down. You can select the rank of the officer, and finally we have demographic information. So I don't think there's any 16-year-old police officers, or 85-year-old police officers for that matter, but we have a wide age range. And so once that officer gallery is generated, people can sort of scroll through the images of potential matches. And if they recognize the face, we do have, in Chicago, the user can then file a complaint if they choose to do so. And so these are the officer profiles. Some of them are more complete than others. For some of them, we have links to news articles and incidents. For others, we don't even have photographs. We just might have a name, maybe not even a badge number in the case of NYPD, for example. But eventually, we hope that these profiles will be quite filled out and have links to all mentions of them, for example, in the news and in recent years. And anyone can go ahead and add incidents to officer profiles.
And the whole goal of this is to have a good answer when, this was from a protest recently in Chicago, when this happens, where people wanted to identify this officer and were unable to. So far we have about 1,000 cops that have been identified across all the departments and a few thousand more photographs that have yet to be identified. So we announced this in Chicago with a press release, and there was kind of a mixed response. People that were in the communities that are affected by policing were pretty hype about the thing, but police were less excited. So the police union, which is called the Fraternal Order of Police, put out a statement describing the project as a little extreme, which is a little bit surprising because all we're doing is collecting data that's already public and just putting it on a website that you can easily search. So it's, you know, that's a view. And unfortunately, we also saw some Chicago area law enforcement blogs describing the project and encouraging police to submit fake photographs. So there's this blog that's apparently very popular with cops called Second City Cop. And they published a blog about us. The first one was called Don't Pose for Cameras, and a follow-up post that encouraged cops to submit fake photos to us. So these photos did end up getting submitted. But it's not like they're scripting it. It's easy to filter those out, and we'll talk about that now. yeah, use Selenium. Okay, so, you should do this.
So essentially, in response to these sort of fake photo submissions, we just added an extra step in the photo verification process. So volunteers can come to our website, and basically they can just go through all of the pictures that have been submitted to us, and they just select yes or no. Are there any police officers in that photograph? So just by adding that extra step, we were pretty easily able to subvert that issue. The next step is to select the face of the officer in the photograph. Obviously, the higher resolution, the better. We try to just make the face as clearly as possible in the photograph. We ask that pictures that are submitted to us include either a name or a badge number, just so that way we have a verification that is the correct officer and the correct photograph that we're matching to that specific officer in our database. And then users can launch the roster, which we've acquired through FOIA requests, search for that name or badge number in the roster, and then basically tag that image and associate it with the unique officer ID in our database.
When it comes to incidents, the way that we've structured it based on talking with groups that want to use this is to allow a set of users to input incidents data, and they only have the permissions to change one department. So they can add officers, they can add incidents, but only in their department, which hopefully they're familiar with. And so that's one of the blockers to adding new departments. We want to identify people that are in that community that hopefully are familiar with law enforcement such that they can fulfill this role. So this is one example of an officer in Chicago that has an incident associated with him, and so then one can go and look at the footage that was on, that's on YouTube. That's on YouTube of his activities in this situation. And that's what we are hoping to build for every cop. There should be one place that you can go and you can find out details of what this officer has been up to in his or her public activities. In terms of implementation, just saying this in case anyone is interested in contributing, it's pretty simple. Python Flask application with Postgres, where we store all the individual level data on cops, and then we put all the images on Amazon S3. And then the four use cases are potential complainant, someone who wants to submit images, that's also done through this web application, an area coordinator who wants to curate their collection for their city, or someone who's a volunteer who wants to sort through photos or identify cops.
Recently we've been expanding open oversight to include federal agencies, which raises a whole host of challenges that we're still trying to work through, and there's a lot we don't know about how to do this right. So you may have seen recently that developer Sam Levine scraped LinkedIn for all people on LinkedIn who list as an active employer Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In response, GitHub and Medium, he had hosted the data set on GitHub. GitHub took it down. He had posted a blog post, and that was removed by Medium. Twitter also banned the bot account that tweeted profiles that came from that data set. So in response to this, Jen and I wrote a post for Lucy Parsons Labs about why making that information, which is already publicly available, why that's in the public interest. So we, for open oversight, we don't use information from social media right now, but we think that this information, which was voluntarily made available by these ICE officials, is something that it's just compiling it in a different way, and that information is absolutely in the public interest. So in light of sort of the recent horrific allegations that have come out about ICE recently, in terms of obviously separating children from families, as well as other horrific violations, we decided to include ICE and Customs and Border Protection into open oversight. So we have active FOIA requests out with those agencies, and we are still waiting to get those back. There's a lot we don't know about how this works on a federal level. Like there's a lot of differences in how local law enforcement agencies work from federal law enforcement agencies. So if you have thoughts on how we can do that best, we'd love to talk to you. So how you can help? Do you want to do this part?
Okay. So how you can help. So if this is interesting to you, first, if you interact with law enforcement and you take pictures of them in uniform, or if you want to scrape. So we don't take information except photos from social media. We have collected a lot of photos from social media and encourage people to do so when it's cops in uniform and in public. So you can submit images on the website. You just click submit. If you want to bring open oversight to your city, what's needed is basically a roster of cops, which you can get by filing. You know, you can just copy-paste the FOIA request that we put up earlier to get that individual-level data, most critically names, badge numbers, ideally demographic information, because it makes it easier to filter down the data set for people who want to find a specific cop. And then just work with the existing community groups in that area to prevent duplication of effort. If you're interested in contributing on the software development side, I encourage you to look at our open GitHub issues. And there's detailed instructions for getting started with Springfield Police Department. That's one of the offices shown in our contributing file. And there's a lot of interesting stuff that could be done in the future. It's pretty clear, you know, if you think about the verification process, a lot of that can be automated. We just did it manually because people were interested in helping, and we're like, well, we may as well do that as a first pass. But both detecting and recognizing faces can be automated, and filtering photos that have cops and do not have cops can also be automated with object detection. And we have a work in progress PR doing some of that, but if you're interested in working on that, please come and talk to us.
And just a quick note, so we actually can't do facial recognition in the state of Illinois because of the Biometric Act, but that constraint doesn't exist in the other states that we work in. So we do have that constraint, but I mean, so obviously it came out recently that law enforcement was using Amazon's recognition. So that's something that we've been exploring using that as well on them.
Yeah, it seems pretty great so far.
Yeah.
great selling point. Yeah, so that Biometric Information Privacy Act that Camille referred to makes it illegal for people in the state of Illinois to collect face markers for facial recognition purposes if as a private entity. So law enforcement can do it, but if we do the same thing, it's actually illegal. So that's interesting. So this is the kind of work that I really think that this community should be doing. In collaboration with communities that have been doing this for decades. And just organizing this information in a useful way can have a massive impact and be really useful. So I hope that you find this interesting and join us, or maybe are inspired to do similar projects. Thanks so much for your attention. So if there's time for questions, which I think there is, there's a mic in the center aisle, which I encourage you to go to so that the stream can hear the questions.
We can't actually see anything, as I think people know by now, so just kind of start speaking if people have questions.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. First, thanks for the statement at the beginning. I think a lot of people appreciate that. So my question is, I see that you're open to expanding to new cities. I'd love to bring this to New Haven, Connecticut. I'm an organizer against police brutality. We have the New Haven Police Department, but also the Yale Police Department, which is like deputized across the city. Do you provide like any sort of training that we can bring to the community on how best to take the photos, how best to submit information? Like, I'm going to go do the FOIA request tonight, but how do we? Do you provide any training that we can bring to like the broader community and other organizers?
So, in terms of like how to take the photos, I think that if there is a cop watch group in your area, they're probably already doing that.
There isn't, unfortunately.
There isn't? Okay. No. Well, there are public resources that we should point people to. Actually, we'll put some together and we'll tweet it out from the Open Oversight Twitter account, because that's a really good point.
Cool. Thank you.
There's also groups like Witness who have released a lot of information about how to do this. In terms of actually gathering the photos, I mean, I think that part is fairly straightforward, although of course you want to make sure that people go in groups and staying safe and all that is really, really important. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that we've done trainings like that before. Just the project started pretty small with just a couple departments where members of Lucy Parsons' labs live. So I think that information is just sort of informally getting passed from person to person. But I think that's, I'm really glad that you're interested in, and we would be happy to talk more with you after whatever about how we can help set up a training maybe or something like that.
You guys got an interesting project, but for the good cops, right, aren't you putting them in danger with the photos? Because a lot of my buddies are cops that are retired.
I mean, for the good cops, what's on the website is just their name, their badge number, which is something that's already available to people that interact with that officer in public, and just details of what they're doing in terms of, oh, they're assigned to District 11 or whatever it is. So we're not actually providing any other particularly interesting information if they're just, you know, keeping quiet and not having a negative incidents, that kind of thing.
And I think that this is information that's already public. We're just compiling public information on these officers. I think that making public information more public should never be considered a danger to anyone's life. I think that's transparency is of the utmost importance. And in terms of like the whole good cop question, if people want to link to incidents on an officer's profile about a good interaction that they had with that officer, they can also do that. There's no sort of constraint about what sort of information people can submit to us.
Yeah, we have an open issue for adding like awards and commendations because that's something that's publicly available. So.
Fuck the police. Yeah.
Hi, I'm from a small town in New Jersey, and our town police department has asked, you know, residents to voluntarily register their surveillance cameras because it can help them solve crime. Now, that's a double-edged sword. And have you seen any this kind of information being asked elsewhere? And if the police department has taken the next step of, you know, trying to control those surveillances, personal surveillances?
So in Chicago, there is a public-private partnership very similar to what you describe. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I FOIA'd to try to get the locations of where those cameras were, and they wouldn't give it to me on privacy grounds because it would violate the privacy of the people surveilling. So I think it's a pretty common strategy. I don't know if they are yet networked together. My understanding was at that time that police would go to, they would say, oh, there's a camera nearby, they're in the public-private partnership, and they would go and get the footage manually.
Okay. By the way, the answer to the first person who asked how to take their pictures, police absolutely love when you go and thank for their services, shake hands, and then you can take selfies with them.
That's a good strategy.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to again say thank you for including your statement at the beginning. It means a lot to all of us. My question for you is about what information, like, do you think you would expand to include something like video? And is there any kind of public available information, for example, if a police officer had his home phone number or address or medical records or something else was leaked? Like, do you draw the line at any point in terms of what information you would host?
People have advocated for us to add stuff like home addresses, but we're not going to do that. We're going to keep it scoped to information that's relevant to their duties directly. So if they're having an incident with someone in the public, that can go in the database. Videos of them in public, totally, that's reasonable to add. And it's something that we're linking out to. We're just not hosting the videos directly for money reasons. But yeah, including other leaked information is not something that this project will do. But yeah, other people can do as they wish.
Yeah, in terms of the video question, yes. There's a few different groups that we're working with. Berkeley Cop Watch is the one in particular, and they have video of different police incidents going back for years and years. So we're trying to work with them to make sure that, those videos, for example, don't include people who might not want their information to be out there. So that is still in process. But yes, we absolutely link out to video that's hosted elsewhere. Yeah, and in terms of the adding sort of personal, non-public information, there's also legal constraints that come with that. There could be potential risk based on some legal advice that we received about open oversight getting taken down on sort of doxing concerns.
Thank you.
I just want to give a shout out to the National Lawyers Guild Legal Observers and ask if you've talked to them or if you have thought about partnering with them to get some of their information.
We have talked to NLG people in a couple of different cities. It's definitely something that we're exploring.
Yeah, in terms of NLG, my understanding is that the information that they have isn't actually, maybe this differs chapter to chapter, so correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the information that they collect from the volunteers actually intentionally stays with those volunteers until it goes to some sort of, until there's some sort of incident filed or until that goes to trial, just to minimize the information that NLG actually has. So, I mean, we're definitely interested in other ways that we can collaborate with any other group, but that was my understanding of the sort of NLG specific information that they have.
Hi, I'm a member of Veterans for Peace. I don't know if some of the people in here know who we are, but after the incident with Tony Baloney, where he pepper sprayed two women who weren't even part of a protest and, you know, put them at risk for blinding, and then we had a member of our own who was hit with a rubber bullet in the head on the West Coast, Veterans for Peace made a policy that at any protest that we participate in where people are, you know, trying to peacefully express their First Amendment rights, we will place ourselves between the police and the public. Our oath did not have an expiration date. So if you guys are getting in trouble, get behind us. See our flags, see our T-shirts. We will place ourselves between the police and you.
Awesome. Thanks for that.
In terms of FOIA and Sunshine requests, are you noticing an increase in the use of personnel exemptions, private information? And this would include an increase maybe in that being used as a way to get out of providing the request, even when that data has otherwise been released by them, say, through their own notes, minutes, other public statements sometimes, including, you know, statements to the news. So this would include badge numbers, names, or DSNs, depending on the jurisdiction.
I think it would be hard to jump to reach a sort of conclusion about whether or not they're becoming, whether they're disclosing less and less information on those grounds, just because honestly, we've only filed those requests for maybe like six or seven agencies, and we haven't even received responses yet for all of them. I will say that in my experience, departments tend to become less and less responsive when you file more and more requests asking for more and more information, at least until you sue them. I don't know if I've noticed an increase in the use of like personnel exceptions. I think that it really just depends on the department. It seems like some agencies are definitely more responsive than others and more likely to use that exemption.
Good morning. A group I work with, we've been doing some of the surveillance that you speak of for quite a while. One thing that we started to do back in 2014 was to import and test and source low-cost body cameras for civilians, for citizens. And as the tactics get more extreme and the courts less responsive, it is kind of a wise course of action to have a copy yourself of whatever what goes down. So if anyone is interested in picking up a fairly low-cost body camera that is invisible in general, and mostly invisible, we could be reached at info@dailyhomosapien.com. And hopefully we'll speak a little bit later.
See, interesting strategy.
I just wanted to follow up a little about the question on good cops. Are you aware of any efforts by organizations of police to create a database of good cops so that they can retaliate against them, or is that just handled informally within the department?
Yeah, it's a good, I don't know if you're joking or not, but
both.
Okay. Cool.
Okay, I guess that's the answer. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm definitely not aware of any such effort. Sorry, I can't. I know someone's saying something, but I can't actually hear what's being said.
Well, just a quick comment that they do have bulletin boards and forums in several in different departments where cool. That kind of stuff is sometimes shared. They're usually anonymous.
Cool. Sweet. Great. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for coming. Oh, I just wanted to make a quick plug that I am New York-based, and we're just expanding to NYPD, so if anyone else is New York-based and interested in that specifically, there's a lot I don't know about doing this work in New York specifically, so please come talk to me about how we can collaborate if you're interested. Okay. Thanks.